For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Jewelry can say many things on your wedding day. As a wedding band, it can say, "This is a forever symbol of our forever love." As a gift to your wedding party, it can say, "Thanks for standing up there with us." Blue Nile can help you find the piece that says it all and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to a quick sort of off-schedule episode of the Sticks and Lacrosse podcast. I know we've been on a little break. We will be back to our regular schedule soon. We are joining you today because the PLL draft has just concluded. The draft took place Tuesday night, May 7th. We could watch it live on ESPNU. It was about, you know, a couple hours long, really, but the whole thing happens up at ESPN headquarters in Bristol here in Connecticut. I was very lucky. I was able to go attend in person this year. So I will have kind of a behind the scenes writing about what the day was like and all that sort of stuff for Lacrosse Culture Daily coming soon. But I wanted to take just a few minutes to kind of talk through the draft itself, who went where, the surprises, the not so surprising stuff, things at the top of the draft, things at the end of the draft. There really was noteworthy kind of stuff everywhere in this draft that was, you know, the PLL has gotten this down, I think. I think we'll just start with that. In terms of the night itself and the draft as an event, I think the PLL has done now a very good job of tuning it and getting this right. And I know this year it gets a little bit of help because the draft class is so good. But even in years you can tell where the class maybe isn't as strong as this one, which is most years. The level of production that they have there, the studio on ESPN, the job that Boyle and Kark do, and then, you know, you have the coaches all there on site. It really is something that's well executed. And it's also like that it's live, I think, is obviously a big improvement over kind of how drafts have been held in the past. I don't know if this is pulling back the curtain for anybody, but for the MLL years and then for the first, I think it might have just been only the first year, maybe the first 2 years of PLL drafts, but those were done like days, a week, more ahead of time, and then they were aired on TV later. So like, you know, if you were really inclined, you could kind of find out what happened where, or, you know, all that kind of stuff. Doing it live eliminates that, and it adds a little bit of drama to it for the coaches who are making the picks. You are experiencing the draft anxieties, the questions, the different scenarios playing out as they're happening. And you can see, you know, coaches experience that in real time. So the live aspect of it also is, it seems like it's such a little thing, but it really does make a big difference. So I think kind of the best way to go through this is we'll go team by team and just kind of take a look at the day. So, and we'll do it in draft order. The first team to draft was, as we all know, the Denver Outlaws. Head coach Tim Sudan had the first overall pick in the draft. The pub coming in was, there's the big three at the top with Brennan O'Neill, Connor Schellenberger, Pat Cavanaugh. As time wore on, it sort of felt like it was down to Schellenberger and O'Neill. In pre-draft talks, in the afternoon, Coach Sudan met with the media. We got to ask him questions about, you know, the draft plan and all that. And he made clear a couple of things. One, that was he wasn't totally sure who it was going to be yet. And two, he said that Cavanaugh was very much still in the conversation for them. He said he was a guy who he called Cav the toughest guy in lacrosse right now. And those are the kind of guys he likes, you know. So personality wise and style wise, Cav was a fit there and definitely was a guy in the conversation for the first pick. Some other kind of just noteworthy or interesting things about the first pick. Coach Sudan did say there were two clubs that reached out about acquiring the first overall pick in the draft. So it's pretty cool that that kind of thing happens. Sudan said he asked for the world for it and didn't get it, so he wasn't moving the pick. As the college season has gone on, it definitely has fluctuated between, you know, way back in January, February, before we had games, it was like, of course it's Brendan O'Neill. And for the last month, I'm going to say it's been, of course it's going to be Connor Schellenberg, because he had been having a great college season and he felt like a guy who better fit the needs, and it was all aligned there. But ultimately for Sudan, you know, we got to talk to him again after the draft, after he took Brendan O'Neill first overall. And he said, look, he talked to guys in his locker room. He talked to other members of his staff. And it came down to, how can you pass on somebody like Brendan O'Neill, who's just so unique, who is, you know, they talked about all these guys being generational talents at the top of the draft. To me, there's one, and it's Brennan. He's the only one who's coming along once in a generation. They don't build lacrosse players like him with that size, that speed, that skill. That's not a knock on Schellenberger and Kavanaugh. They're exceptional players, but when I think of a generational player, I literally take it to mean once in a generation. And Brendan O'Neill is once in a generation. The other guys aren't. So I don't think you could pass on him is kind of where Sudo landed and ended up taking him. So their picks were Brendan O'Neill at one. They had the first pick in round two, pick number 9. And there they took Jake Pisano, the LSM from Albany. They had the third pick in the second round, 11th overall. And there they took Graham Bundy, the midfielder from Georgetown. And then later on in the third round, they added Josh Sawada, who is an attackman who played initially at Michigan and is currently finishing his college career at Duke. And then late in the game in the fourth round, they grab a face-off guy. They're the only one taken on the night. They take Luke Weirman, the face-off specialist from Maryland. So looking at those picks, Brennan, obviously we covered. He's once in a generation. I know there's a concern where he plays that lefty attack spot and Logan Wisnowskis is currently in that spot. I don't think there's any problem running Brendan O'Neill out of the box. I believe Tim Sudan said he didn't have any kind of problem with it at all. I think they've talked about it. He had even mentioned that Logan had said he would run out of the box. So O'Neill ran out of the box for Team USA and looked very good doing it. PLL, of course, is a different game and a different level of competition, but Brendan O'Neill is still a special player. I don't think it's crazy to suggest that he will run out of the box and it's any kind of mismanagement of Brendan to do so. I thought Jake Pisano to them with the first pick in round two was a little bit surprising. And I say that because not as a knock on Pisano. It's so hard to do this and have me say something about somebody that's not 100% positive and not have people read it as, oh, you must hate that guy. I love Jake Pisano and he's an awesome player. But I think the plan that people were expecting the Outlaws to stick to was offense, 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 offense. Their problem last year was on offense, not defense. They need weapons. They need dynamic players on the offensive end. They have 3 picks in the first 11. They got to go offense, offense, offense. So at number one, of course, they do. To see them deviate and take an LSM that early, I think was a little bit of a surprise. Sudan said after the draft, he loves Pisano and that, you know, he's a guy he's excited to have around. They were very, very happy to get Graham Bundy at pick number 11. He is a 2-point threat for them. They were not a team that was hitting a lot of twos. They were not stretching the field last year in a way that, you know, you kind of have to in the PLL now. If you don't have somebody who can hit a 2-pointer and stretch a defense out a little bit, then it gets kind of tough to create some space for your offense if you can't stretch somebody that way. So Bundy, I think, is a good add for them there. The pick in round 3 is the one that I think you really look at as, okay, they got what they needed in the draft. Because their need in the draft big time was a quarterback kind of guy, a attackman who can be comfortable behind the goal. When they had Nick Turn, things were cooking. Wisnowskis was playing great. Without Nick Turn, things didn't go quite so well. Coach Sudan in the past has built his teams with guys like Nick Turn, with guys like Jordan Wolf. You know, he likes to have those kind of guys behind there. So it was something that they needed. I think as the draft got, you know, those first 3 picks went by and they didn't get one of those types of guys, you know, it became clear that, all right, they need to do something here in round 3. after the draft, Sudan had said that they had a scenario that they were ready for where they would have taken Matt Brandau at 9, but Brandau did not make it out of the first round to them, so that got scrapped. So then they, you know, that's how they wound up kind of with Pisano there. But in round 3, they take Josh Sawada. So Sawada is very much a quarterback type, is a pass-first attackman, a head-up, separate-from-my-man-and-look-to-feed type of player. So he can play behind the goal for them and be that kind of guy. I think Sawada is a really good pick there because if it's not the 2024 draft, Sawada is probably a first two rounds kind of player. He's going around earlier. You know, he's going 8 or 9 picks earlier than this most years, but he's not this year. So I think, you know, you can be very happy if you're an Outlaws fan getting this guy where you did. Don't say, oh, we use a third round pick. How good is he really? He's really good. He's really good. I have to go look at Duke's numbers right now, but he was leading Duke in scoring for a good chunk of this year. Not Brendan O'Neill. And then, you know, again, I mentioned Brendan here, but you get a season worth of connection between those two, of Sawada and O'Neill playing together at Duke and now playing together in Denver. So the Outlaws kind of get everything they need there. And then, you know, with the last round again, Luke Wehrman, the only faceoff guy taken. I do expect maybe, you know, the Water Dogs, I would expect to at least have somebody on the roster who's a faceoff specialist. They don't right now. They didn't draft one, but Luke Wehrman is the one that goes. He goes to Denver. Denver did just re-sign Connor Farrell for a year too. So, you know, they'll have some options there. Wehrman at a minimum is a guy who could push Farrell at best, that he becomes their every week faceoff guy. You know, we'll kind of see where things go with him. But the Denver draft, I thought, was pretty well executed. You know, you get Brendan O'Neill, hard to knock that. You get the QB you wanted in Josh Sawada in round 3, which I think is good. You know, if you're in the market for the quarterback attackman, we all know there's Schellenberger and you know, Kavanaugh as distributor type attackmen, and Brandau is maybe just a little bit of a step below them. But if you're not getting one of those three guys, I don't think the difference between a Josh Sawada, a Ross Scott, a Mikey Boehm, you know, even maybe a TJ Malone. TJ Malone's probably a little bit better, but he was gone by the time the Outlaws made their pick. I don't think, you know, the Sawada, Scott, Boehm group, there's not a ton of separation between those three. So if you know you're not getting that elite group, then maybe it doesn't kill you that you wait until round 3 to get the QB type. So, you know, that's the Denver draft. This will segue nicely, again, some of the conversations with Pseudo after the draft, and I'll get to the good one in a second here. But the Atlas pick 2nd. They take Connor Schellenberger at 2, an obvious pick for them. They had opened up a spot for a righty attackman by trading Chris Gray in an effort to acquire the 5th overall pick. So Atlas with 2 picks in the top 5. They spend number 2 on Schellenberger. That attack immediately looks like Schellenberger, Jeff Teed, and Eric Law to me. I know everybody's going to want it. Whenever it happens every year. It's hilarious. It happens every year. The Atlas make picks in the draft, and everybody starts doing their, like, oh, the attack's going to be this, these three guys, whatever. And Eric Law's just never in it. Eric Law's going to be an attack for them. If he's playing and he's healthy, he's going to be an attack. You can't play him anywhere else. He's too good. He's too smart. He's too good of a player around the goal to say we should run Eric Law out of the box. Their attack is going to be Schellenberger, Jeff Teat, and Eric Law. Like, it just has to be. I can't imagine it going another way. Xander Dixon can keep running out of the box, all this stuff, you know. But anyway, they take Schellenberger. You get, I mean, two just remarkable ball distributors now in your righty and lefty attackmen of Schellenberger and Jeff Teat. The assist total should be off the charts. It should be an offense that hums really well with those two as guys who just want to move the ball and carve up a defense and get the ball to the right guy all the time. So Schellenberger is the easy pick there at 2. At 5, the Atlas used that pick that they acquired to take Liam Entman, to take the goalie from Notre Dame. They trade Chris Gray and the 13th overall pick to get the 5th pick. In the moment, I did not love this pick. I just didn't. And I'll tell you why. Entman is, you know, he's got to be regarded as the best goalie in the group. He's in the Tuvarin conversation right now. He really, I mean, you know, so Enemann is a special goalie. He's you know, the prospect you want to get if you have a goalie need. And the Atlas clearly do. Jack Kincannon retired. Yes, they bring Trautner in free agency and they have Drake Porter, but it's a position where you draft somebody if that was your goalie offseason. Entman's the guy they take. I looked at Entman at 5, and then I look at the picks between where they took him and where they pick next, because their next pick comes at 10. It's the second pick in the second round. So there's only 4 teams picking between when the Atlas take Entman and when they make their next pick. Those teams are the Canons, Colin Kearse, don't need a goalie. The Water Dogs, Dylan Ward, Matt DeLuca, don't need a goalie. The Archers, Brett Dobson, don't need a goalie. And the Outlaws, Sean Scannone, Owen McElroy, maybe, but Sudo has been clear that he loves their goalies, and Scannone's great, and all that. And then the Atlas. So you're telling me they got to pick Entman at 5 when he's probably going to be there at 10? I don't know. That's why I didn't love it in the moment. And then I was loud wrong. I was very wrong on this, because after the draft, I'm talking to Coach Sudan, and he's saying, as they were going through the different scenarios for the draft day, he said he was talking about getting Brandao at 9, and they didn't get Brandao there. He said they had a situation where they were looking at taking Liam Enemann at 9, even with their great goalies that they love. He had said if Entman was there at 9, he would have had a really hard time passing Liam Enemann. He's just that good. And I found that to be fascinating. And so did Coach Pressler, who was standing maybe 8 feet away with a big grin on his face, hearing Sudo say, oh, I wasn't letting the amendment go by. Because that validates the whole move. It validates the whole deal. It's what the Atlas needed to do to get the goalie they wanted. And Pressler said, at every position in the draft, basically, you can debate who the best guy is at that spot. Who's the best attackman in the draft? Who's the best middie? You know, attackman, it's, you know, most people are going to say it's Brennan and the other guys. Okay. But midfield, defense, the LSMs, you know, whatever. He was saying, making the point, you can debate the best guy at every position in the draft, really, except goalie. It is clear to him that Liam Enemann is the best goalie in the draft and, you know, a long-term pro going to be successful right away. So Atlas get their guy and Liam Enemann. At 5, they get Jake Stevens at 10 with the second pick in the second round, which I love. I mean, I'm a big Jake Stevens fan anyway, because if you have a need, he fills it, whatever it is. You don't have to tell me what it is. If you got Jake Stevens, he fills it. You need somebody who can play some D-middy? You got him. Wing on a faceoff? You got him. Dodging midfielder? You got him. Just a shooter, an off-ball player? Done. Man down middy? Sure. He does everything. And the PLL guys like that are at such a premium. So I think a very good pick there for Atlas as they bolster the middle of their field a little bit. They didn't pick in round three because their third round pick is the one that went back to Redwoods and the Chris Gray deal too. So they had to wait as the third round unfolded. And then their last pick was the second pick in the fourth round, where they took Tyler Carpenter, the LSM from Duke, who Coach Pressler he explained after the draft has kind of a long connection to. He said when he was the head coach at Duke, Tyler Carpenter was their ball boy, which is hilarious. And that there are also some family connections there. So it sounds like Coach Pressler and Tyler Carpenter go way, way back. So, you know, it's a good spot for him. It's a guy they can trust, and he can push that LSM group for time, for sure. He has such a high motor. He's so good on ground balls. Those guys that get the ball up the field and everything for them are, you know, they're a crucial part of the game now. So a good late round pick there for Atlas. Picking third in the draft was the Whips. The Whips, you know, early in the day, again, at the press conference portion of the day, a lot of the questions were for most of the coaches usually centered around kind of where they saw the big three at the top shaking out and how it affected where they would be drafting. For Coach Staggs, he was picking third, and he was picking third overall, but then not picking again until the 17th pick in the draft, the first pick around 3. So he had to make sure he got that third pick right. And when he was doing that, you know, he looked at their roster. You looked at what kind of offseason they had. Bryce Young not with the team anymore because he was traded to Boston. Connor Kurst, part of that deal too. Michael Earhart retires. There is a need for them on the defensive end in a big way. They need another stopper on the defensive end. They got hit too hard in the offseason to just ignore it. And Coach Staggs, before the draft, was saying, look, that's a big need. If we don't address that, you know, do we need guys at X attack? Sure. Which one of those two needs can we, do we need to address at three, and which one can wait until 17? And it's pretty easy to look at the depth at the positions in the draft and understand what he was saying in that moment, that they needed to go defense at three and get their guy and then, you know, evaluate who was there on the offensive end later. So they take Ajax Zapatello at three, the guy they considered to be the best defensive player in the draft. Again, a stopper for them. I think a guy who will be a close defenseman for them, so it doesn't necessarily solve the Earhart retirement, but there's other options for them, obviously, where they can continue to look at that. There's plenty of good polls that will be post-draft ads, and they still have a guy like Elijah Gash, who we haven't seen a ton of. So they take Zapatello at three, and then they are the beneficiary of what I think was one of the bigger stories on draft night. TJ Malone doesn't get drafted in the first round. I personally thought he was first round good, but in a draft like this, maybe he slides to the second round. Okay, not crazy. TJ Malone doesn't get taken in the second round. There's a run on midfielders ahead of him. There's a couple other attackmen that all get taken ahead of him. Dyson Williams goes ahead of him. And then Stagnetta, Coach Staggs, is saying he's got that first pick in round three. He said after the draft, you know, when the Archers took Dyson Williams at the end of round two, he was like, holy shit, Malone's really going to make it to us. And so they get TJ Malone. They get the Penn State star who's, you know, an exceptional Dodger, another kind of heads-up player. Staggs has always kind of spent these off seasons looking for more guys that basically can just draw slides consistently, that can take pressure off of guys like Rambo and Zed to do all the dodging and do all the creating. It's what their rationale was for drafting Dordovic a year ago, and they got that, and I think they're getting another guy like that here. You know, after the draft, Coach Stagnetta said, hey, look, we basically got everything we wanted. They get Zupacic, the LSM from Villanova, in the third round as well, who Stagg said he you know, loved what he saw from him, particularly here at the end of the college season and conference tournament play, and did make the remark that Villanova just seems to crank out LSMs, which, I mean, they do. Karalunas, list goes on. You know, it's Villanova puts out plenty of good LSMs. Zupacic is the latest. And then in round four, with their last pick, they take Adam Poitras from Loyola, who is, again, another kind of pass-first player. We'll kind of see how he fits in with them, whether it's an attack or midfield. It feels more like a midfield kind of move there, but, you know, the Whips do that. And then Stagg said, look, there's guys that he had on his board that went undrafted that he's got to get claims in on. They have the third spot in the claim priority. So he wouldn't... I asked all the coaches after the draft, all right, what didn't you get that you're going to try and target on Thursday? Because Thursday is when the post-draft claims get processed. And they're all like, well, we have guys, but I'm not going to, you know, Staggs in particular is like, I'm not going to tell you. I don't want to overplay the hand here and say, we need these polls so somebody else can also put claims in, because there's two teams ahead of them in priority order. So, you know, I think we'll see what kind of moves that the Whips make. There's definitely still some needs they need to address. But I think they get, you know, if you want to call it the steal of the draft, I think, you know, whatever the language is, but TJ Malone at the 17th pick, the first pick in the third round, and you're getting a guy who's a first-round talent, graded as a first-round talent, even in this year's draft. Certainly in last year's, definitely would be in next year's too. He's a first-round talent, and you get him at the first pick of round three after watching all those other guys go. I'm sure the Whips were loving that. The fourth pick, team picking in the draft, was the Chaos. Coach Towers, you know, before the draft had said, look, we have the guy that we love, and if he's there, we're taking him there. and it would take something special for him to not come to us there. That guy was, of course, Shane Knobloch. You know, Towers had some telling moments again in that pre-draft press conference time where he talked about, look, we're a team that's shifting offensive philosophies right now. They played with a lot of guys with a box style background for years in the PLL. And Coach Towers talked about other teams adding more box players or more players with box backgrounds joining the PLL, and that giving other teams an opportunity to better prepare for them, to better prepare to play the chaos and to understand what the chaos we're going to be trying to do. And so in that sense, I think the league kind of caught up to them a little bit. And this is Towers recognizing that and saying it's time for, he said, this is a shift in philosophy. So you saw it with free agency where they signed Jules Henningberg, they signed Sergio Perkovic, Kevin Rogers. These are not box players. But that was kind of the beginning of this stuff. And some of it, too, is, of course, related to availability. You know, Dane Smith, Ryan Smith, Chris Kluche, they won't be around this summer. So, that right there kind of dictates maybe it's time to start making these moves. But Shane Knobloch, certainly a player who can be at the cornerstone of that philosophy change, because he's a two-handed midfield dodging player. He is going to be seeing poles in the PLL, I would imagine, pretty quickly, in the same way that Dordovic did last year. It's going to become obvious pretty quickly that he can separate and shoot with both hands with a whole lot of speed, with explosiveness that not many guys have. So the Chaos add another midfield weapon there. They get another middie. They get Eric Dobson in the second round at the fourth pick. I think that, you know, I would imagine that they were kind of holding out for Bundy. I think they wanted Bundy, but Dobson, of course, not a bad consolation prize. Towers, of course, loves him as well. You know, we asked all the coaches post-draft, were there any big surprises? And Towers says his big surprise was that he got everybody he wanted. So he gets Eric Dobson, legit two-point threat, a really, really good player who's, you know, you hear it when you watch the Notre Dame broadcast now, or you hear it when you hear like Kark and Quint talk about him, but his numbers are down from where you might expect them to be or where they've been in the past, because he's such a good midfielder and has been productive in the past. But if you really get in there to watching and to breaking down what he's doing on the field, to really watch him play and get into his film and everything, you can see how much he's impacting the game. There are hockey assist plays out there. There are plays where he is, you know, stretching a defense, opening up space for others. He's drawing a slide and starting a rotation on the defense that ends with a few quick passes for a good shot. You know, so the plays that he makes are not always box score stat plays. This is one of those things where if you just sort by points, you're going to find him a good ways down the list. But that is not a good way to evaluate Eric Dobson. So they add Dobson in the third round. In the fourth round, they add Ross Scott, who, in the moment, I was like, I don't know. I didn't always necessarily love this, because you see Brian Minnickus on that roster as a shifty play from X, you know, change of direction dodger. And Ross Scott is very much the same kind of player. So one of them is going to be playing in the midfield. Which one? Again, Towers said postgame, we're going to put them both out there and let them compete for the spot. And, you know, the one that we think gives us the best chance to win from X goes and plays at X. The other one's going to go play in the midfield for us. So, you know, Towers is always adamant that the guys he drafts are okay with that approach, and you have to be okay with that to stay a member of the Chaos. So that'll be Ross Scott's fate, is to come to camp and try and compete with Minnickus to win that spot at X. But, you know, Towers also mentioned, look, whichever one does play in the midfield is going to immediately be a matchup problem, because they're both good enough to command poles, and one of them won't get one. So, you know, that's one where I was like, okay, you know, that felt like a best available kind of move. And then round four, Towers did the Towers thing of stashing a player who will not be available this summer. They take Dylan Hess, a short stick D middie from Georgetown, who is going to be playing football next year by all accounts. Because he is not returning to school to play lacrosse, he does not re-enter for the draft next year. The Chaos, basically by drafting him here, hold his rights for 2 years. The first of those 2 years will be the year he is playing football, and then they own his rights the year after that. So this is a bet that Dylan Hess will not go to the NFL or whatever, and will come back to lacrosse after a year of football. Towers, you know, has a way of rationalizing this by saying, look, if the guy that I, the other guys that were left on the board have no chance of making the roster, but Dylan Hess has a 5% chance of returning to lacrosse and making the roster and being really good, then of course I'm taking Hess. So it's that kind of thinking. Dylan Hess, you know, if nobody took him this year and he was in next year's PLL draft, he would be a very, very well-regarded short stick D-Mitty prospect. Next year's short stick D-Mitty class is very good, or at least of guys who will be seniors and will be, you know, technically draft eligible. Hess would be part of that group, but he would be one of the leaders of it for sure. Picking fifth in the draft, we already mentioned, was the Atlas again. We kind of did them already. Picking sixth was the Cannons, who take Pat Cavanaugh. And in the first round, that was kind of the story. And I think there was a little bit of narrative around this coming into the draft. I know I had put it out there. I thought Cavanaugh could slide. I think Ryan Boyle mentioned on the show before the draft started, Cavanaugh could slide. So to see him down at six, I think it's surprising to actually look at his name and see it there. But, you know, that's the way things go. I think the way other teams were drafting for need and for what they really wanted for their locker room, what they were setting out to get, what their plan was, it kind of just created the storm where Cavanaugh could fall a little bit. It was funny, in the afternoon, again, in the pre-draft press conferences, is where some of these narratives really start, and this one did in particular for sure. Kevin from TLN asked Coach Holman about the possibility of having the Cavanaugh brothers play together, having Pat and Matt on the same team. And if Matt had been in his ear, Coach Holman was, you know, like, oh, you know, with a laugh, like, yeah, you know, Matt's texted me about it 50 times and all that. And Coach Holman said, look, we would love, I'm paraphrasing here, we would love it if that happens. If there is a scenario where it somehow happens that he slides to us at six, you know, we're probably going to take him. So that's the scenario that unfolded. I realize there's maybe not a natural attack fit there because Asher Nolting is there, Marcus Holman is there as the righties, and then obviously Matt is there as the lefty. I think you can't pass Pat Cavanaugh at six, though. He's just too good. And you look also at you know, Marcus is not young. He's not a rookie. You know, you start getting ready for your righty attack when Marcus Holman decides that he's going to hang it up. Pat is that guy. Pat runs out of the box right now, however they decide to do this, but he's just too good and fits too well with the Cannons to pass there. So, you know, his slide to six was certainly kind of the story of the first round. Because, again, he was this big three. Everyone thought they were going to go 1-2-3, and then he drops to six. I think as it became, you know, closer to draft day this past week, certainly during the day today, it became less of a big three and more kind of a big five or big six for these first five, six picks, where everybody kind of had a feeling who was going to go, certainly 1-4, and then 5 and 6 in some order, and then it was figured out after that. Let's see. In the second round, the Cannons take Alex Verdaro, who is a very good midfield prospect, and I think fits, again, the narrative started in the afternoon. Coach Holman had said, when asked, you know, where do you want to get better, a place he thought that they could have some improvement was in the middle of the field. He said he wanted to be more explosive. So much of the game is won between the lines, played between the lines in the PLL. That's very much where Verdaro, you know, he checks those boxes. He is an explosive dodger, some midfield depth for them, and he's a guy who plays well between the lines. So, you know, it's maybe a little bit of a surprise to see him go ahead of guys like TJ Malone, guys like, you know, Josh Sawada maybe a little bit, but certainly a very, very good player. Round three, the Cannons did not have a pick. And then in round four, at the very end of the draft, they take Scott Smith, a defenseman from Hopkins, who's excellent, but also, as Kark alluded to on the broadcast, I think may still be able to return for another year. of college lacrosse. And if he does that, then obviously the Cannons will not retain his rights. That pick kind of felt like a speculative, we don't have a ton of needs left, we'll take this guy in case it works out. You got to remember the Cannons also have Cade Sostad on the holdout list from last year. Like, they are so set on defense. So maybe Scott Smith works out. Maybe he's a holdout list guy, you know, whatever kind of happens there. But really the Cannons' big splash in this draft, the big thing that it worked out for them was they get Pat Cavanaugh to fall to them at 6. The Water Dogs pick 7th, and they take Matt Brandau at 7. So it was interesting because in the, again, talking about when the narratives start in the pre-draft press conferences, Coach Tierney talked about, we need to be younger on defense. Our guys are getting old down there. We need some defensive depth. A lot of what he was talking about seemed to focus on that side of the field. So to see him go Brandau at 7, I think kind of took me by surprise a little bit. I was expecting a pull here maybe, or a defensive side of the ball here guy maybe. But look, Brandau is also, as Boyle mentioned on broadcast, he is excellent Michael Sowers insurance. Sowers is a guy who's, you know, had a share of concussions at this point. He's been banged up quite a bit at this point. I don't think he's had a full healthy season since he's been in the PLL. So you need a guy like a Matt Brandau who can step in and play at X and be a distributor. But Matt Brandau can also run out of the box for you. He can, you know, he dodges very well from high wings for Yale. He's deadly from X and from the low wings, as we know. He can create for his own shot, or he can be a feed-first kind of player. He does everything. So the Water Dogs offense has been built that way. Brandau, whether it was Tierney or Andy Copeland making this pick, is a fit for the Water Dogs. In round 2, the Water Dogs take Kenny Brower with the 7th pick in the round. So that's the, whatever it is, the 15th pick. And after the draft, Coach Tierney said they actually had scenarios where they took Kenny Brower at 7. So they were thrilled to get him around later and have him still be available to them. They didn't want to pass Brandau up, so, you know, they take Brandau. He had said they had some scenarios where they thought Entenmann might go as high as 3. Coach Tierney said they had some kind of draft boards where, you know, all right, well, we have to be prepared for a scenario where the whip stakes take Entenmann, which was surprising to me. But, you know, I think, again, they take Brandau in that first round, which they're thrilled about, because Brandau definitely would not have been there at 15. They pass on Kenny Brower, which they had a plan to do. And then Brower is still there for them at 15. So they get a very, very good close defenseman in Kenny Brower, alluding to that need from earlier that Tierney had talked about, that we need to get a close defender and get younger down there. They do it again in round 3 when they take Marcus Hudgens from Ohio State. Hudgens is a great player. He was off the charts good at West Point and then transferred to Ohio State, where he still has been very good. He is a pure cover defenseman. And I think that's a guy that it sounded like, talking to Coach Tierney, that was something he felt like they really needed, was a lockdown cover defenseman. So they get Hudgens there. And then they get Mikey Boehm at the end of round 4 with the second to last pick in the draft. You get Mikey Boehm, who's, again, like, so much better than a 4th round player. It's just that kind of year. So they have another kind of, you know, it's a Brandau-like player, a pass first or, you know, a distributor kind of QB type attackman. And, you know, whether he runs out of the box or he gets stashed a little bit, but there's other kind of ways that Mikey Boehm can work into a lineup there for the Water Dogs. With the last pick in the first round, the defending champs, the Archers, they take Mason Woodward, a defenseman from Marquette, who it was funny to hear basically the unanimous take, like, oh my goodness, nobody's heard of Mason Woodward. He's, you know, he plays at Marquette and nobody sees them. Yeah, Marquette's not on TV a lot, but they also, like, they don't play nobody. They play Notre Dame, they play Georgetown, they play Penn State. Obviously, they played Denver, you know, Villanova, they played Michigan. They played a very good Utah team. Like, they played good teams. I think what might have, if you want to find something that hurt Woodward from a everybody's talking about how good he is or a visibility standpoint, other than that he's not in, you know, one of the conferences that people watch the most, is that Marquette played a lot of zone this year. because, you know, a team that did not have a great season. So when you have kind of that down of a year and you play a lot of zone, it can be tough to really stand out to just, you know, the casual fans and everything. But for anybody who's really breaking down the film and watching Mason Woodward play, he's a star. He's an absolute star. There was some gas when he went at the end of round one, ahead of Kenny Brower, ahead of every defenseman in pole in the draft, other than Ajax Zapatello. The second long stick off the board at any position was Mason Woodward. And I promise you this, he will make a play week one for the Archers that will make you say, oh, I get it. Yeah, they got the right guy here. I think his footwork is second maybe only to Ajax. I think his physicality is different than every other guy in the draft. I think he's bigger and stronger than most other poles. I know some of the mocks have him at LSM. I think he is a close defenseman through and through. It's where I expect the Archers to play him. I think he could play LSM in the PLL, but I think his close defense is I think where he is naturally inclined to be. And I think it's where the Archers have a need for him with the Matt McMahon retirement. You know, they have the righty-lefty thing to consider there, but, you know, I Woodward was just too good. I was not at all surprised to see him in the first round. I think in early versions of my big board exercise, I think there were times where I had Woodward as like the second best defenseman in the class or first defenseman in the class. I love him. So he goes to the Archers, who were, from talking to Bates, ecstatic to get him. They loved him. The second round, the Archers take Dyson Williams. You know, talking to Bates after the draft, I think they, as many people have kind of talked about, see Dyson Williams as a player who can do more than what he's doing, you know, what his role is kind of at Duke right now as kind of this just crease finisher guy. But it sounds like they would love to use Dyson in the pick game, in the two-man game, you know, maybe as a Dodger if he's getting shorties, that kind of thing. So I'm excited to see how they kind of expand his role a little bit. Also in the second round, I should not have skipped this, in the middle of the second round, with the pick that the Archers got by trading Jared Connors to the Redwoods, the Archers take Bo Patterson, the short stick D-middy from Michigan. Patterson is not only pretty much the only true short stick D-middy in the draft, he is the best. He's really good. He's really good. He's a fifth pole level short stick defender. And before the draft, Bates had said that they considered short stick D-middy a need because they have Latrell Harris out. So with just Bond and Marr ready, they needed another guy. You can't just go to battle with two of those. So Patterson was the natural target to them. I think where they got him is where it made sense for him to go. I thought he could have been as early as a first-round pick if a team really felt that was a strong need. They wanted to make sure they got the guy that filled it. He is the one in the draft that really crushes it for you. So I thought he could have gone earlier. I think the Archers, I'm sure, are thrilled to get him in the middle of the second round. So they get a short stick D-middy, and then they get Dyson Williams in round two. In round three, they take Colby Bars, defenseman from Towson, who I think has played his way up draft boards and everything over the course of this year, but really in recent weeks. So you could see kind of the way Archers were kind of building from the defensive side of the field here, their offense. I think they're feeling very, very good about Dyson Williams. They add, but, you know, otherwise you're really looking at adding just strictly defensive players. And then they trade their round four pick to the Redwoods, the last pick in the draft. They traded to the Redwoods in exchange for the Redwoods' third round pick next year. Speaking of the Redwoods, you may have noticed we didn't mention them as picking in round one because they didn't have a round one pick. They dealt it for Chris Gray. And you might have noticed we didn't mention them as drafting in round two because they didn't have a round two pick. They dealt it for Jared Connors. Their first pick came at the beginning of round three where they took Garrett Degnan, attackman from Hopkins, who, he's going to be a middie at the pro level. But they like those big midfielders. They take another one later. They take Levi Anderson in the third round as well. I have always been a very strong proponent of Levi Anderson. I love his game, and I think him paired with John Grant Jr. is match made in heaven. Both are very big, very strong, physically talented with a very strong box background for Levi Anderson, and Degnan with a range from, you know, a good 16, 17 yards. So two different guys in terms of what they do best. Anderson is very much a pass, create leverage and pass first kind of player. Degnan is a find me off the ball through a skip lane and I'm going to let a rocket go kind of player. So very different in that regard, but both big bodied. Nat loves those big midfielders, both well over 6 feet, both well over 200 pounds. They're, you know, just more of these kind of physical mismatch kind of guys for the Woods. And then in the last round, the Woods take Chase Erlin. Nat said they had a pretty close between Erlin and Willmark. Ended up going with Chase Erlin. You know, there's some natural connections there. It's TD's brother. You know, they know him already. They know he's going to fit in the locker room. There's comfort there. So I get why that would kind of, if it was really, really close between Erlin and Willmark, how that kind of puts Erlin over the top. I think Willmark's the better goalie, but, you know, locker room stuff really does matter a ton in this league. And then the last pick in the draft, this one is going to be chatted about a little bit. The Redwoods acquire, they just can't stop making trades. The Redwoods acquire the last pick in the draft from the Archers, and they do it in exchange for their third round pick next year. And with the last pick, they select Cole Kastner, defenseman, Virginia. Why does this matter? Because Cole Kastner is playing basketball at Stanford next year. We all know that. So this is a stash pick. We want him down the road. But what if he Pat Spencers? What if he goes to play basketball in Europe afterwards? What if he goes to tries to make the NBA? After the draft, we were talking to Nat about this, and Nat was being coy about it. We were saying, you know, you stash Cole Kastner, what did you like about him? And Nat was saying, you know, we're not going to get into it right now, but we feel good about it. We feel good about the pick. Very, you know, in doing that, very strongly hinting that the expectation is that Kastner is going to play basketball for a year. And that's the year. That's it. It sounds like Nat is very confident that Kastner will return to lacrosse. So if he has the intel and he has the, you know, he knows that he's getting Cole Kastner a year from now and stashes him for a year. Look, if Cole Kastner was in the draft this year, he'd be the number one pole on the board. He would go ahead of Ajax. He'd be the best defenseman on the board. He will be the best defenseman on the board next year if he's in the draft next year. Nat, if he is sure he's playing, is getting him with the last pick in the draft this year. And that's a steal, man. At the cost of your third-round pick next year, that's a steal. So that's everybody's picks. I think, you know, if you want to look at some of the undrafted guys that I was surprised to see undrafted, the top of my list, I think, is Peyton Cormier from Virginia. He's in the midst currently of chasing down Mac O'Keefe's all-time goals record. I believe he's 13 or 14 back of him, which with a deep tournament run is doable. For Virginia to have a deep tournament run, it's doable for Cormier if he can get hot. Otherwise, he's at worst, he's a 200-goal scorer in college. There aren't too many of those. So I think given how good he is with his hands and finishing and shooting off the ball in a league where so many teams need complementary pieces, it was a little surprising for me to see him go undrafted. I thought Willmark, if you had told me two goalies would be drafted and one wouldn't be Willmark, I would have been surprised. I think Willmark is a great future pro. He has seen so many shots, and I think there's something to be said for playing behind a defense that really doesn't have any pros on it and still being a very successful goalie in college. Because the defenses you'll play behind pros at the pro level. The offenses will be pro level good too, but you will have been out there having seen a million different shots, having seen, you know, games where the other team is just better than you and you're going to see a ton of rubber and you're going to stand up to it. I think there's something to be said for that Willmark can say he has that the other goalies just don't. So I was surprised to see Willmark go undrafted. I was talking with the IL guys after the draft. They mentioned, you know, Scott Cole, I think, was surprising to go undrafted because he's number one, lightning fast. Number two, versatile. Usually those guys are at a premium in drafts, not undrafted. Cole can play attack, play midfield. He can be a dodger. He can be a facilitator. I thought seeing Scott Cole go undrafted was a little bit surprising. And then Roy Meyer went undrafted, the BU LSM. And the last time there was a first-team All-American LSM that we all just kind of forgot about and went undrafted, it was this kid named Ethan Rawl. And it worked out for the team that picked him up. So I don't know if Roy Meyer can do the same, but that's a first-team All-American who went undrafted at the LSM spot in a draft that was pretty shallow on the defensemen and LSMs. So that was a little bit surprising, too. I think those were the guys where – those are the first couple guys I really thought of for undrafted, really. But that was the draft. I think the next thing you see here is coaches now will put in claims – and on Thursday, the post-draft, like, waivers or whatever you call them will process. And teams can take their roster now up to 30 guys. So normally it's 25. You can add 5 extra guys, go to 30, and that's your group to go to camp with. And then you cut down. There's 2 cuts down, basically, from 30 to your 25. And then it's not really a cut down, but from your 25 to your 19 for game day. So I think there will be every single coach in the league, every single one, after it was over, said, there are guys on our board who we love who went undrafted and we want to claim. So I think the post-draft waiver period here will be the Wild West. You'll have the order, the priority order is very much going to matter. And teams will be trying to make a difference with guys now. There will be 19-man roster guys that didn't get drafted that get picked up on Thursday. It's like I guarantee it. So this draft class was special. The greatest draft, as the PLL called it. I think we're all kind of excited to see this next group. And I think it's a signal that training camp, man, is right around the corner. It's not months away. It's weeks away. It's less than a month away. So I'm looking forward to it. I hope you are too. That's going to be our quick draft recap here. Thank you for tuning in and for sticking around with me, and we will see you next time.